rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello, you're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. Patrick Maguire here, in for Matt Chorley for the next couple of weeks. And we're starting off with a brilliant podcast today, if I do say so myself. We're going to be talking about how you lose an unlosable election, lessons from around the world and across history for Sir Keir Starmer there. But first, it's time for The Columnists.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on Times Radio.
Yes, time for Libby Rachey with Libby Purvis. Morning, Libby.
Morning.
And Rachel Sylvester. Morning, Rachel.
Hi, Patrick.
Great to have you both. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I'm sorry if there's building. We've got builders at the moment. There's banging, rather.
I thought that was rapturous applause, Rachel, for another
well,
searing insight.
Yeah. You may hear meowing cats as well. It's all go here.
a chorus of fans. Libby, any builders in today?
No, but the rain stopped here, which is nice.
Lovely. There's a blue sky for the first time in a while outside here. So, hope springs eternal. Anyway, let's get cracking, shall we? Liz Truss, that's a name we hear surprisingly often given the way her premiership ended. This morning's Times reports that she's nominated one person for an honour for every 4 days she was in office. 14 people are still on her resignation honours list, which is being vetted as we speak by the House of Lords Appointments Commission. And it could have been even longer, two people turning down the nomination by the former PM. Wisely, I would have thought. One source said they thought it would be humiliating to receive an honour from Truss. Are they right, Rachel?
I think so, yes. I think most voters would think that anyway. There seems to be more self-awareness among some of her aides than in Truss herself. And it just reminds me, I bumped into someone who'd worked for her soon after her premiership crashed to a disastrous end. And they said she was the only woman in politics who had absolutely no imposter syndrome. And in fact, this former aide said she could have done with a bit more of it. There's that sense of, there's a shamelessness to this, isn't there? She sort of crashed the economy, sent mortgages soaring, even Kwasi Kwarteng, her chancellor's paying more in his mortgage, we read. And yet she thinks, people who backed her and sucked up to her deserve an honour.
Do they deserve honours, Libby?
And if we have to go on having these political appointments to the Lords, then one per year of your premiership should be absolute maximum. It's been brought into such massive disrepute by Boris and now massive disrepute by Liz Truss. It's a disgrace.
So I'm going to put you down as a maybe, Libby.
No.
Well, yeah, of course. It could have been worse, though. Truss has got 14 people on her honours list. Boris Johnson's list said to have been whittled down to 40 from almost 100. But the interesting thing, Rachel, is, you speak to Labour people, and while Gordon Brown early this year, big report in which he said abolish the Lords, now we're already seeing that commitment being watered down slowly. I know I reported in The Times a couple of months ago that there's an acknowledgement in Labour circles that they'll probably need to appoint lots of peers in the interim to make sure they can pass legislation. The Sunday Times reported last week that they're planning to abolish hereditary peers, or rather new hereditary peers, replacing hereditary peers who die off as an interim measure. There's no sign that, despite the you know, incredulity that stories like this, Liz Truss appointing Piers, will provoke in people listening. There's no sign that actually big sweeping reform of the House of Lords is imminent, is there?
No, and I've been reporting on Lords reform from since 1996, I think. I was the Lords correspondent for the Telegraph at the time. And, even then it was being discussed. And the problem is nobody agrees on what should replace the House of Lords. And the peers themselves obviously don't want to be abolished. So you end up with this kind of stasis. But this is a slightly separate issue, I think, the giving of honours by outgoing prime ministers, and also the use of honours as a sort of political bauble and reward for sycophancy. And I think that, you know, those two things could be separated out. You could say, actually, we're going to end this culture of cronyism in the Lords, but still, you don't have to wrap it all up with the entire reform of the Lords.
So not too dissimilar to what you were suggesting, Libby. If there's a need for political peers, disentangle it from, you know, the period of the process rather of giving people, you know, bribes or inducements for political support.
Giving a title and a sort of credibility, and not least the attendance allowance to these people who get the political crony appointments. And I think it's a disgrace. I mean, I think the scale of it makes it a disgrace. If there were only a very few, you know, if a prime minister really had to choose on leaving office after a decent spell of years, you know, who are the really valuable people and have them 3 or 4 or 5, however many years have been there. But this idea that, you know, Liz Truss can sort of vogue in, tank everything, and then put up a lot of people for honours and attendance allowances, you know, which costs us money, it just makes the country look so really disreputable. I mean, this is the problem. I mean, I agree with Rachel. We, you know, the Lords have their uses. They really do. And good, intelligent, fantastic people, some of them. But it's been heavily mismanaged and nobody will reform it. I don't see the next government reform. I don't see anyone reforming it. You know, they've all got their mates who want to get in. It's just horrible.
It's in what politicians call the too difficult box, I think, Lords reform, as Rachel was saying. Also proving a very difficult political issue over the past couple of years is A-level results and exam results. You know, obviously, systems scarred by the pandemic. About 50,000 teenagers next week set to miss out on top grades they would have achieved last year, according to an education professor. Many school leavers like to be disappointed with their results, leading to a surge in appeals, probably, according to his analysis. Grades are supposed to be returning to pre-pandemic levels, but this would lead to almost 100,000 fewer A and A star grades being awarded. Because Rachel is the chair of the Times Education Commission, you can explain that, you know, during the pandemic, grades were sort of corrected upwards to reflect the, with teacher assessments to reflect the difficulty students has had. But now we're basically seeing the hangover from that, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. And they're kind of downgrading them again, having uprated them all during the pandemic. And it can't go on that, you know, I think it was in 2021, nearly 45% of A-levels were either an A or an A star. That's obviously absurd. You can't have that level of top marks going to so many students. So there is an adjustment, and that is painful for those who suffer as a result. But I'd say actually there's a wider problem with the whole exam system, and that students, children, young people aren't being judged in the round sufficiently. So on the Education Commission, we said that A-levels should be replaced with a much broader baccalaureate, which would let you do humanities and sciences or vocational and academic subjects, and also have some more emphasis on character with things like volunteering and creativity. So rather than this very narrow measure of success, which leaves lots of people feeling like failures, there ought to be this kind of much broader measure and system. And I remember speaking to Mary Beard, the Cambridge professor, who said that, since she started teaching at Cambridge, the way in which students approach education has completely changed because the focus has been so much on exams. They now say, you know, how do I get a first? What do I do? What mark scheme do I have to tick? What box do I have to tick to get a first? She says, no, you have to think until your head hurts. And we've lost sight of that sense of education being something about intellectual endeavour. It's all about marks. I think it's a broader problem.
What do you think, Libby? Is Rachel right that we need a broader sort of plan?
Yeah,
here?
So at the Times Education Commission came absolutely, you know, bang up with the right answers as far as I was concerned over this. And they are, I mean, there is a terrible unfairness about the whole system. But, I mean, we have, the way we have since the great lockdown time, the way we have messed around our young people, the schoolgirls, the A-level schoolboys, the A-level group, and now, of course, these poor students who are unable to get degrees, they often just a handshake because nobody will mark their final dissertation, you know, because of that strike. I mean, we have absolutely messed them up. And speaking as a pampered boomer, I am ashamed at the way young people in education have been treated in the last few years. I hang my head. You know, if anything one could do or vote to change this attitude of the sort of disposability of young people, especially the least privileged young people, you know, I would do it.
Rachel, but any politician, as Gavin Williamson found 3 years ago, is going to find it really difficult if in a couple of weeks' time the story is lots of otherwise diligent and hardworking students have missed out on the university places they've been hoping for and have worked really hard for. You'll have parents up in arms. You know, this is affecting 100,000 people. Any education secretary is going to find it quite difficult to withstand the political pressure to do what the government have done over the past couple of years, which is end up sort of correcting upwards again. And, you know, the prediction is a surge in appeals. I mean, politically, this is going to be very difficult for the government to manage, isn't it?
Well, I think that just shows why there's a need for this broader reform, because the system's completely broken. And if anything, the pandemic created a kind of reset moment because exams were cancelled for so long and there was this kind of grade inflation. So it's a time to just step back and think, actually, what do our children need to learn? The things that they're learning at school aren't preparing them for the jobs that they're going to do in the future. It's a sort of rote learning, tick box exercise, memory rather than, you know, problem solving or creativity or originality. And it's bad for the economy and it's bad for children and for their mental health. And actually, really interestingly, the research that we did for the commission found that parents are really dissatisfied as well, that 2/3 of parents think that their education system isn't preparing their children either for life or for work. So actually, a brave politician who sees that bull by the horns and said, look, this is a mess, we're going to think again and we're going to do what's right for the children and for the country, I think would actually win praise in the end, even if it involved some controversial decisions along the way.
From what you've seen, Rachel, just briefly, do you think Keir Starmer and Bridget Phillips and all those politicians, do you get the sense they're thinking boldly about reform of the exam system?
I think they are. I think they may not say so before the election. That's what's really interesting, is there's a caution about what should be in the manifesto. But I know that behind the scenes, they are looking at all these things. They promised to have a review of the curriculum and the assessment system if they win. When Alice Thompson and I interviewed Bridget Phillipson recently for the podcast, What I Wish I'd Known, she was very clear that there needed to be broad reform and that the system needed to become much more relevant. So I think they won't necessarily set out the details in full before the election, but I think the direction of travel is pretty clear, actually.
Right. Now, I'm sure our columnist panel are nodding their heads to that one. That is, of course, as listeners of a certain age remember, the music to WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. And Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder, says he's ready today to enter the ring for a cage fight with Elon Musk, the owner of the social media platform formerly known as Twitter. The pair have agreed to the bout. They agreed to the bout in June, with proceeds going to a charity for veterans. But Zuckerberg now says Musk is yet to respond to his invitation for a bout on the 26th of this month. Gareth A. Davies is a boxing and MMA journalist and broadcaster. He joins us now. Gareth, who's your money on, Elon or Mark?
Good morning, Patrick. Swung straight into my pick. Well, I'm probably going to go for Mark Zuckerberg, actually. He's 13 years younger at 39. I think he's about a stone and a half lighter, but he is a jiu-jitsu practitioner. And I suspect that if he can get Musk to the mat, he may well submit him in a mixed martial arts fight. And I reckon his manner of victory would probably be something like an armbar, or if I can call it this, a rear naked choke. And I can imagine Elon Musk tapping, but it really is a kind of bragging rights fight for the big swinging egos of our planet, really. I mean, these two guys are emperors in a sense, if you look at what they do. And the weird thing about fight sports, you know, as someone that's covered it a long time, is that, you know, look back into the history, as you'll be aware of, the emperors used to have their gladiators fighting Colosseums. And this, weirdly, is two emperors fighting over. It's a kind of a bragging rights fight in lots of ways. But I just wonder also whether them having seen that we've had a lot of major influencers, what some people are calling hijacking the fight sport scenario to garner big numbers. Because, you know, you shout fight, fight, flight, fight in the playground and people will always flock to see it and rubberneck to see it. But I think it might well end up, if it does happen, as the most watched fight in history, maybe even the richest fight in history.
Libby, will you be watching?
No. Seven people have died in fully regulated MMA cage fights. One of these two might die. I'm not sure which one I'd be gladder to get rid of. I've just been reading the rules, by the way, but if you want to be reassured, no headbutts, eye gouging, biting, spitting, fish hooking, face bars, hair pulling, or throws that aim your opponent's head to hit the canvas. No strikes to the spine. Sounds no fun at all, doesn't it?
That was Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. Remember, you can read both of them in The Times every week. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox and you get yourself a digital subscription.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Now, how do you lose an unlosable election? Indeed, is there such a thing as an unlosable election? The latest YouGov polls have Labour 20 points clear of the Conservatives, with near enough 12 months to go until polling day. Keir Starmer is keen to ensure his party doesn't get complacent, however.
The Tories will never give up on power. That's not who they are. So no let-up, no complacency. Fight for every vote.
Yes, complacency is the dirtiest word in Labour HQ, and that is wise because it wouldn't be the first time a party with an enormous poll lead facing an unpopular rival has ended up with a shock defeat. Three elections are preoccupying people in Labour HQ. the general election in the UK in 1992, the US presidential election in 2016, and the Australian general election in 2019. We're going to be speaking about all of those in our big thing this morning. And I'll be joined throughout by our political commentator, Isabel Hardman. Morning, Isabel.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Very well. Great to have you in the depths of recess, making our own news today. First question for you, Isabel. The polls, 20 points ahead for the Labour Party. Even a year ago, that would have been pretty implausible. Do you think the Labour Party, one, believes those polls, and two, mean what they say when they say they're not complacent, or are they already measuring the curtains?
I mean, I think there's a split within the Labour Party. So, as you said, Keir Starmer is obsessed with the word complacency. And I think one of the reasons he is that he's taken a lot of lessons from the 1992 election, which I'm sure we'll discuss in a bit more detail shortly, where Labour did think that they were, to coin a phrase, all right. When you then boil down through the front bench of the Labour Party today, you've got two groups. You've got one group who really think, you know, this is in the bag. This is going to be OK. Look at this useless bunch of Tories. They're exhausted. They need a spell in rehab, let alone a spell in opposition. We're going to walk this. And then you've got the other group who think, actually, this poll lead is very, very soft. It's much more to do with people being, as that first group have articulated, fed up with the Tories, who are knackered rather than excited and energised about, you know, the new Labour Party. And, you know, as Keir Starmer himself has said, these days are not the things can only get better days of 1997. There's not that energy in the country. But a lot of Labour front benchers think there's not that energy around the Labour Party either, and that there's a huge amount more work to be done to make people excited about voting Labour, to actually make people comfortable and relaxed about voting Labour. So there is that split, and it often boils down really to the spending pledges that we see or we don't see from the front bench, where you've got Rachel Reeves, who is very much of the we must not be complacent camp, trying to rein in the ambition of some of the other front benchers who really see the spending restraint at the moment as just being one of those sort of, you know, we're in holiday season, sort of pre-holiday diets that you then go crazy once you're on holiday, once they're in government. So there is that kind of tension between front benches.
And you mentioned spending commitments. In large part, the sort of psychology of the Labour Party on spending commitments and tax rises and that sort of thing going into an election, what people have in their minds is the memory of that Tory poster in 1992, Labour's tax bombshell, you pay £1,500 more under a Labour government. So let's take a look at that election, a defeat that really did shock the pollsters here in the UK. That was seen basically as an unlosable election for Neil Kinnock, and that's the one that keeps shadow cabinet ministers like Rachel Reeves and her deputy, Pat McFadden, the two most important people in the shadow cabinet, as you say, up at night. Labour had, ahead of that election, on average, a 7-point lead for much of the build-up. But when I spoke to Neil Kinnock about it last year, he denied, despite that famous moment at the Sheffield rally, as you said, Isabel, when he declared, "We're all right," he denied that he was complacent.
Did I go into the election expecting to win? The answer is no. My highest expectation at any stage, and that was in the first week or 10 days, was for a hung parliament with possibly as the largest single party. But that was the maximum expectation I had. And as the campaign went on, that faded somewhat. So that by the time we actually got the result, I was dismayed, obviously. That's an understatement, but I wasn't surprised. In fact, I was devastated because of the effect that I thought it would have on the people of our country. But other than that, there was no real surprise.
So not all right then, according to Neil Kinnock. But where did it all go wrong for Labour? I also spoke last year to Chris Patten, Lord Patten of Barnes, who is credited with masterminding that shock win for John Major.
And I just don't think that Labour was trusted with the economy. And smart aleck, as Peter Manderson might have been at the time, and producing a glossy campaign, it just didn't cut the ice with normal voters. I knew that we'd won the election when somebody came to me and said, "Look, I've just been out canvassing, and people keep on saying to me, why aren't you producing lots of slick stuff about the things that really matter, like taxes going up if Labour wins the election? And I thought, well, if that's what people are saying on the doorstep, they've actually got the point without us being slick in the way we present it.
Isabel, do you think Labour have really learned the lessons of that defeat?
I think they have. I think one of the things that's interesting that they continue to cling to, and this is one of my own obsessions as well, is the NHS, which was a big feature in the 1992 campaign with what was known as the War of Jennifer's Ear. It was a Labour broadcast about a girl who'd had to wait, I think it was a year, for vents to be put in her ears to treat glue ear, which is quite a common childhood condition. And this descended into a big fight about whether Labour were being honest, about whether Neil Kinnock was telling a pack of lies. But the reason Labour did it was because they saw the NHS as being fertile election-winning territory. And you still see the Labour Party retreating to the NHS as fertile election-winning territory whenever it feels that other things are going a bit better for the government. And I think that the lesson from 92 is that actually the NHS, as salient as it is, doesn't win elections. It can, you know, add to the impression, I think, of a government that's lost its way. And it was certainly an ingredient in 1997 when you had Tony Blair saying, you know, we have 24 hours to save the NHS. But it's not the thing that clinches it. And I think that's a lesson that probably Labour still needs to learn.
And the other thing, we're talking about, you know, the salience of issues during election campaign, Chris Patten picked up on it there, is much will depend, the shape of the campaign will depend on whether the Tories can, ahead of the election, do what they did in 1992, which is essentially bring forward a big tax-cutting budget. You know, Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak are hinting, is probably too subtle a word. They're basically saying that's what they're going to do. Norman Lamont did that on the eve of the election. John Major then dissolved Parliament, and the campaign was basically, well, would you like all of these tax cuts or would you not? I mean, I think we're going to see something similar to that if the economy is in decent enough shape or has improved this time next year, do you think, Isabel?
Yeah, that's certainly, as you say, what the great clunking hints are from the top and what the demands are throughout the Conservative Party as well, because what Conservative MPs argue is that while voters are, you know, not happy, they don't particularly think that the Conservatives are making a good fist of handling the economy, they're still very anxious about the Labour Party. And that was very much the one of the big factors in the 1992 election, was that Labour had gone through this terrible period through the 80s where they just appeared completely at odds with what voters were interested in. And Kinnock was obviously part of that modernisation project, but he didn't take the Labour Party far enough for voters to feel comfortable about backing it and taking it into government. And so what the Conservatives want to do is to say, look, you know, essentially, you think we're bad, but look at the other guys. They're still not worth trusting. And here are some tax cuts to keep you comfortable. I suspect we will see echoes from the Conservatives of what they tried to do in 97, unsuccessfully, obviously, with the New Labour, New Danger posters.
The famous demon eyes poster, yeah.
Yeah, the scary eyes coming out of the purse. Those sort of warnings that Keir Starmer is just desperate to put your taxes up as much as possible.
Well, those are the lessons from 1992 that are ringing in the ears of people in Labour HQ as Morgan McSweeney, Keir's campaign director, urges them against complacency, I'm sure. What are the lessons can they draw from history, the Labour Party? And are they really taking them to heart? That's the question we're going to consider. We're looking at the unlosable elections that may spell disaster for the Labour Party next year. And Neil Kinnock, who of course lost that unlosable election in 1992, is far from the only politician to lose an election that appeared to be in the bag. In 2016, Hillary Clinton was widely expected to stroll into the White House given the unpopularity and lack of political experience of her divisive opponent, Donald Trump. But as we know, the polls and predictions got it wrong, with the Republican candidate flipping key states in his favour.
This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for, and I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country. I know how disappointed you feel because I feel it too. This is painful, and it will be for a long time. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will.
That was Corey Jukes, former state director for the Clinton campaign. Oh, pardon me, that was Hillary Clinton herself. Now we're going to hear from Corey Jukes, state director for the Clinton campaign in Pennsylvania, one of the states that unexpectedly voted for Trump in 2016. He is now a policy advocate for Protect Democracy, a group dedicated to defeating authoritarianism. I spoke to him earlier and I asked him if it's right to assume people on the Clinton campaign expected they were going to beat Donald Trump easily.
By the time our team was constructed, it was clear that then-candidate Trump posed a serious threat electorally. So I think even though we were leading in the polls, the public polling, and even frankly in some internal polling until very late in the campaign, I don't think that there was an assumption that it was a fait accompli or that the race was ever a done deal.
And Pennsylvania, for British listeners who might not be familiar, has some similarities sort of economically, socially, with key seats that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are focusing on here, which is to say much of the state is sort of deindustrialised, you know, that sort of thing, the sort of old industrial mining towns. And that became Trump country in the election, didn't it?
It did. It did. And you know, I think we had an inability to properly respond to and maybe in some cases properly recognize the traction that Trump was gaining in these areas that you describe in a state like Pennsylvania, which has large rural areas and large areas of previously booming industrial areas that may have fallen on harder times. So we saw him have an ability to appeal to and turn out to the polls large kind of populations of new voters or voters who are infrequent voters who were particularly taken by his brand of populism.
It's interesting because you mention Trump's ability to connect with those sorts of voters. Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party here, has spent a lot of his 3 years as Labour leader trying to rebuild the Labour Party's relationship with those voters, despite the fact he himself is what you might reductively call a London liberal, in the same way that I imagine lots of people associate Hillary Clinton with, you know, with DC and New York and not necessarily the sorts of places that proved so decisive in that election.
Sure, but I'm not sure anyone associates Donald Trump with anywhere other than Manhattan either, or his various estates around the country. So, you know, I do think that one thing that we saw was, again, this brand of populism that frankly tinges towards authoritarianism had a much larger audience than we anticipated. And I think that one maybe instructive piece that applies to the current situation in the UK is it's not enough just to be an alternative to a bad candidate. You have to offer a vision for how you are going to serve these seats and these populations to provide them an affirmative case to support your candidacy and your party.
Do you think that's something you struggled to do in Pennsylvania?
I think that we lost by 45,000 votes out of maybe out of nearly 6 million votes cast. So the margins were very, very tight. I think that we may have tried to draw bright distinctions between the ideals and the vision of Secretary Clinton and something that we thought was uniquely dangerous in Donald Trump. But I'm not sure that we did it consistently enough. And obviously, it did not gain sufficient traction to provide us the margins that we needed in places like Pennsylvania, Arizona, Michigan, other similar states across the country.
And as you say, the margins were very, very tight. And had, you know, Trump energized a few thousand fewer voters, or if your campaign energized a few thousand more, we might be having a very, very difficult conversation. You know, and how much of that is key, sort of identifying your vote, getting it out? I mean, I imagine you did that in Pennsylvania, but as you say, the problem was Trump turned out a lot of first-time habitual non-voters, didn't he?
He did. And, you know, another piece of the standard principle or basic rule here is that all politics are local. Sometimes we try to nationalize races, we try to nationalize our politics, but there is a local appeal, there is a local choice happening between two candidates or two parties. And I feel like we obviously did not do an adequate job of turning out enough of our supporters to offset the surge in new and infrequent voters that the Trump campaign was able to turn out with their message.
There's a truism in British politics, I don't know whether it's the same in US politics, that campaigns don't really matter, that people have basically made up their minds at the outset of a campaign, and very little that happens during a campaign can shift it. And the Labour Party, given that they're 20, 25 points ahead in some opinion polls here, will certainly be hoping that's true. I mean, would you say that's naive? Because there were certainly turning points during the campaign. The one people referred to is, of course, the FBI announcing very close to polling day that Secretary Clinton's emails, were going to be investigated again, or that they found new emails on Anthony Weiner's computer. Would you say, you know, what happens during a campaign can be decisive? Was that your experience, or is this sort of second order marginal stuff?
Oh, no, most definitely. In the States, obviously, and you've alluded to it a couple of times now, our elections are in November, and we have the concept of an October surprise, where in the days or weeks before the election, something unforeseen happens that's out of control of the candidates and the parties that might have a major bearing on the outcome of the election. You mentioned the Access Hollywood tape from early October of 2016. The James Comey letter and press conference was actually October 28th, 2016. And if you'll indulge me, I think this is illustrative. On that day, I was traveling with former President Bill Clinton across Pennsylvania. He was doing some get out the vote stops. And we started the day in Western Pennsylvania, which is a former steel town, or a steel town that has fallen on harder times, but has a real affection and residual well of support for President Clinton. So we started the day, and you could feel the wind behind our sails. Like, it was a very positive morning. And we got on the plane to fly across the state to the eastern part of Pennsylvania, to the Lehigh Valley. And while we were on the tarmac, the press conference from then FBI Director James Comey took place. And we went wheels up. We flew for maybe 45 minutes. We landed in the Lehigh Valley. And the tone of the press corps that was with us was different. It was clear that something had changed in the race. And this was, I believe, like, you know, 9 to 10 days before election day. And it had a great bearing on the outcome of the race.
And if I may, what do the Democrats need to do next year to make sure there isn't another unexpected or unpleasant defeat to President Trump?
Well, I work for a nonpartisan nonprofit, and I'm retired from electoral politics. But I do think we've learned from across the world that the authoritarian threat doesn't die easily. In our country, we are unfortunately faced with a former president and a current candidate who has tried to lead us down that path. And we at Protect Democracy are convinced and on guard against the second instance of an authoritarian president, because the second round is always more efficient and more harmful than the first round.
That was Corey Jukes, former state director for the Hillary Clinton campaign in Pennsylvania, one of the states that unexpectedly voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And speaking of shock defeats, or rather expected victories, England have just gone through in the Women's World Cup, beating Nigeria 4-2 on penalties. So there's some good news for you this morning. Now, to Australia. In 2019, Bill Shorten, then leader of the Australian Labour Party, was the sure victor of that year's federal elections. That was according to the opinion polls, political pundits and betting markets. But to everyone's surprise, the Scott Morrison-led Liberal National Coalition secured another 3 years in government. Bill Shorten resigned as leader of the Labour Party after accepting defeat.
I know that you're all hurting, and I am too. Gee, I wish we could have formed a government for these Australians on this evening. I wish we could have won for the true believers, for our brothers and sisters and the mighty trade union movement. I wish we could have done it for Bob.
That was Bill Shorten resigning as leader of the Australian Labour Party after accepting defeat in the 2019 election. Ryan Liddle was his chief of staff. He joins me now. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. And I hope that clip wasn't too traumatic to listen to. Talk us through what it was like the moment it became clear that the polls were wrong and that Labour was going to lose. You know, just how surprising was that?
Well, it was quite surprising. I mean, I don't think anybody ever took anything for granted. Certainly Bill didn't, and certainly I didn't. But, you know, we had a consistent sort of performance over the previous sort of year. We kept announcing sort of new policies, and the polls kept falling into our favour. And then we had a sort of a difficult campaign where we'd inadvertently, but quite deliberately as well in some respects, made ourselves quite a large target. We had quite a significant sort of policy offering, because all the feedback and the research and the polling that we had showed that that's what people wanted. They wanted a they wanted a break from the, you know, what the research was showing us was the chaos and disunity of the 30 parties and onto a sort of a fresh approach and a new vision. So that's what we sort of kept offering. And then that meant it was quite right for a scare campaign, a fear campaign. And the votes certainly on election night didn't fall in the seats that we needed them to be.
You know, and you talk about your campaign becoming a target for a scare campaign from the Liberals. What listeners may not know is that the very person who ran Boris Johnson's campaign in 2019 and will likely run the campaign for the Conservatives in 2024, Isaac Levido, a protege of Linton Crosby, whose name that will be familiar to listeners as, you know, the Wizard of Oz, as Tories know him over here. He ran that campaign against Bill Shorten too.
Yep. Yep, that's right. And you can see, I mean, you know, my understanding and interest in insights into UK politics certainly isn't as sharp as yours, Patrick, but from a sort of a from reading from afar, you can see the same sort of themes starting to develop. You know, we had during the 2019 campaign here, we had a focus on electric vehicles, which Scott Morrison, the Conservative or the Conservative Prime Minister, said on live television repeatedly that it was going to end the weekend for Australians. Now, media reported that polis as it was, without any sort of critical analysis, and that devastated us. I mean, just this idea, this absolute rubbish that was out there without any sort of critical analysis, it carried through, and that really hurt us.
There was also an issue with the reliability or otherwise of the opinion polling, which suggested you were going to win, but the reality didn't quite match the data.
Yeah, that's right. And so basically across the board, you know, we had consistent opinion polling right up until, well, it was up at sort of 56-44, two-party preferred for a lot of the time before the 2019 election. And even the night before, you know, there's a tradition in Australia that there's a big, the Australian newspaper, he'd have a big news poll that splashes into the papers on election day on Saturday. That is ahead 51.5 to 48.5. And so the political editor of the newspaper called me and said congratulations the night before. And it turned out that, you know, obviously that was a spread across various sort of states and more national than in the seats that we needed to win. So we found that in seats that were sort of safe Labor seats, you know, our vote there went up, which was pretty unhelpful in the scheme of things. And in the marginal seats that we needed to win, we just couldn't get there.
And if you could offer one piece of advice to your sister party in Britain ahead of an election that does bear some resemblance to the one you fought in 2019, what would it be?
One of the things which I think is quite similar, Patrick, is that when Scott Morrison here became leader, you know, knocked off the previous Prime Minister in the same way that Rishi Sunak knocked off Liz Truss, and Morrison here was able to recreate himself as a, you know, as different from the Conservative Party here, even went to the extent of calling his own party a bunch of Muppets because he wanted to differentiate himself that much from the chaos and the sort of dysfunction of the previous years. So anything the party can do to sort of bolt Rishi Sunak to the history of the chaos with Truss, Theresa May, et cetera, not only does it remind people of the chaos and dysfunction and remove his ability to sort of recreate himself, reminds people of how long they've been in power. Mm. And one of the devices that we had down here, we called it the Mount Rushmore of, I'll say, morons for the purpose of your audience. And we had a billboard. We just basically had the five faces of the various sort of leaders lined up, and we put that all over the country. And that was really effective in so far as painting that sort of picture of the dysfunction over those years.
Well, advice that the Labour Party are taking to heart, I know from Ryan Little, Chief of Staff to Bill Shorten, who lost unexpectedly Australia's federal election in 2019. That's all we got time for on today's podcast. Remember, I'll be back tomorrow. And don't forget to share, subscribe, like and follow wherever you get your podcast from.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? why do they do it, and how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.